loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. 15 years ago yesterday, more than 10 million people around the world participated in mass demonstrations in opposition to the U.S. decision to attack Iraq. It was the largest mass one-day anti-war mobilization in world history. All these years later, the U.S. military is still in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and it has armed troops in countless other countries around the world. We're going to take a look at militarism and war and the global forces that are trying to change course. Then we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of the courts, our prosecutors, and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. But first we turn to the 15th anniversary of what was the largest anti-war demonstration held globally. That was February 15, 2003. We had an interview yesterday on the day of that anniversary when more than 10 million people stood up in the streets of cities all around the world to say no to the looming war in Iraq. We were joined by Michael Preisner. He was an Iraq war veteran. He became an anti-war activist. And by Cindy Sheehan, a Gold Star mother whose son was killed in Iraq. Both of them became principal leaders in the U.S. anti-war movement during the past decade. Cindy and Mike, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's such a remarkable chapter in American history, and it's largely, you know, again, forgotten, sadly. You know, at the time of the U.S. invasion of the Philippines, there was a big movement against the war in the Philippines, the emergence of the United States as an imperialist power. That was just about 100 years before the Iraq invasion. And there was something called the U.S. Anti-Imperialist League, led by Mark Twain. And a huge part of the population participated, trying to stop the what was turning out to be endless war, the Asia Pifid back then. That was the invasion of the Philippines in particular in 1899. A million Filipinos died. Of course, at the same time, the U.S. seized Cuba and it seized Puerto Rico and other territories that had previously been Spanish colonies. Mike Preisner, when this massive demonstration happened in February 2003, and I'm just for the audience to understand, I was, as the director of the Answer Coalition, one of the organizers of those mass protests. You were not part of the anti-war movement. You, in fact, were part of the war movement. You were on your way or about to be on your way to Iraq. Talk about what happened to you real quickly and how it turned out as a consequence of your experience that you sort of switched sides.
Sure. Well, I was 19 years old at the time. And, you know, this is joining the military just a couple months before the September 11th attacks. And so the military I joined in the military that quickly developed after the 9/11 attacks was a very rapid thing. But I was in Fort Drum, New York, when the war drums for the Iraq war began, and things happened pretty quickly. It seemed like a matter of weeks before we had desert camouflage, and we were, you know, staging in Italy to be a part of the initial invasion of Iraq. And yeah, I mean, I was one of those people that was believing what I was told, looking for answers, looking for what was going on, but believing what we were being told by all of our commanders and leadership and friends and things like that. But really, it was just a couple months in the country before I started to realize that all of the rationales for the war, all of the talking points, really kind of went up in smoke based on, you know, what we were seeing on the ground. I mean, I will say at that time, in the weeks leading up to it, you know, we weren't just kind of blindly waiting to go. I mean, we were trying to find out what was going on. We were, all of me and my friends, we'd all be in our barracks room at night watching the news, trying to see what was happening, trying to find out what was going to happen. And, you know, we were really searching for answers, and there really were none at all. And so I remember for the weeks leading up to it, watching the news every night and seeing only reasons why we should go and justifications for why we should go. And so I remember seeing that demonstration in February, and that was the first anti-war voice that we had seen anywhere in the media in all of the weeks leading up to the invasion. And so I think that, you know, I think a big part of a lot of us believing in what we were doing at the time was because there simply was no other alternative opinion that was being presented to us until we were, you know, had our own opinion to deal with.
Cindy Sheehan, let's find out where you were and what you were doing in February 2003. By August 2005, Cindy Sheehan had become, I would say, the most well-known anti-war leader from the United States all around the world as a consequence of her vigil that drew like a magnet people from all over the country and the world right outside George W. Bush's ranch, which you named, Cindy, Camp Casey after your son, who was killed in the Iraq War. Talk about where you were in 2003, though, in your own sort of transformation.
Well, interestingly, about Camp Casey, there were four Iraq veterans against the war there on us, with us on the initial day, and they're the ones that suggested that we name it Camp Casey. So Camilo Mejia was one of them, probably well known to all of you guys. But anyway, February 2003, the U.S. had been already at war for over a year in Afghanistan. I opposed that invasion. Many people did not. Many people thought that, you know, Afghanistan has something to do with 9/11. And then when the anti-war drum started beating against Iraq, I mean, we were appalled. Casey came home. Well, we talked to Casey a lot, and he was home a few times before he went to Iraq. Also, like, was very confused about why the United States was going to invade Iraq. And it seemed like there was going to be nothing that stopped it. Colin Powell go to the UN with his little vial of whatever he had, you know, just complete and utter propaganda for invading Iraq. But on 2003, Casey was in the 1st Cavalry in Fort Hood. They were supposed to go to Afghanistan. Then they didn't go to Afghanistan. Then they were going to participate in the initial invasion of Iraq, but then they didn't. And then he was sent there a year later. But I didn't know about the anti-war protests, or I would have joined one. I think there was a large one in San Francisco. I definitely would have been there. I wasn't plugged into the community like I am now. And so then the thing that I find very interesting is that there were millions of people that went out, like you said, and 600 different demonstrations around the world. But then when the U.S. invaded, pretty much everybody just kind of, you know, gave up the ghost. They didn't really have any more very small anti-war demonstrations after the initial invasion. And so, like you said, I think it wasn't really sparked again until August of 2005. And then we had that huge demo in Washington, D.C. So if I had been on the answer list in February 15th, 2003, I definitely would have joined one of those protests.
Brian, I was at the CIA at the time that this was all playing out. I had returned from Pakistan and was working in CIA headquarters. I had just been promoted, and I became the executive assistant to the CIA's associate deputy director. I didn't know exactly what I was supposed to do. And on my first day on the job, I was told that I needed to go upstairs to the sixth floor and sign a stack of secrecy documents. And then once I signed, I would be told my assignment. So I went upstairs, I signed, it was something like six different secrecy agreements. And finally I said, okay, so what gives? I just assumed because I had come from Pakistan, I'd be doing something against Al-Qaeda or the hunt for Osama bin Laden or something. And the officer who signed me in said, okay, here's what we're doing. Next year, we're going to invade Iraq. We're going to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we're going to open the world's largest air force base in southern Iraq so we can move all of our air assets out of Saudi Arabia and deprive Osama bin Laden of the ability to say that the United States is polluting the land of the two holy mosques. I was so shocked that all I could think to stammer out was, but we haven't caught bin Laden yet. And he chuckled and he said, look, the decision's already been made. We have no say-so in this. We're going to invade Iraq whether we like it or not. And that's exactly what happened.
Say again, when was it?
This was August of 2002.
Okay. That's really interesting and important. In August 2002, I was in Iraq. I had gone with Ramsey Clark and others to document the fact that the U.S. was bombing the country. And Mike, I'm sure you're aware, ever since December 1998, every day the U.S. bombed Iraq. This was before the war started. The U.S. was bombing Iraq every day. And I was going with Ramsey Clark. We went to Basra. We went to Mosul. We went to, of course, to Baghdad. We went to the Anbar province, Ramadi, all of these areas, because the U.S. was bombing them every day. So we were interviewing the families of people who had been killed or horribly wounded, or people whose homes had been destroyed in these bombing attacks. But it was clear that the U.S. was getting ready for a war, because this was the softening up operation. They were trying to find out how Iraqi air defenses would respond, things like that. I can remember I came back in September 2002, and along with my colleagues in the Answer Coalition, we went around to all of the liberal organizations and we said, there's going to be a war. We all know there's going to be a war against Iraq. Congress, which was getting calls 300-1 against the Iraq war from their constituents. In other words, the country was against the Iraq war, the coming war. But all of the liberal groups, I'm telling you the truth, most of the mainstream liberal groups in America said, we're not going to organize street demonstrations because we have to work in Congress. That's where we'll be effective. And we said, that's a dead end. Congress will ultimately cave in and give George W. Bush what he wants. And they did that in October. They authorized the use of force, October 2002. So the Answer Coalition initiated a demonstration on October 26, 2002. And shock of all to everyone, 200,000 people came out. And then we called a demonstration for January 18th, 2003 on the Mall, and 500,000 people came out. So we're 200,000 in October, 500,000 in January 2003. And again, in San Francisco, a sister demonstration, also about 50,000. And then there was an international call that came sort of at the end of December, but after that October 26, 2002 demo, where the whole world was asked to come out on February 15, 2003. And that's, in fact, what happened. And Mike Prizner, at the time, it seemed so powerful, and it's so shocking to me when I hear you say you hadn't seen any of the other demos when you were in your barracks. The media finally covered the February 15th, 2003 demo, because you couldn't not cover it. Nothing like that in world history had ever happened, where 10 million people in every country, even in small Eskimo villages in the northern part of Alaska, people were having protests. I mean, literally villages that had 40 people. So the media had to pay attention. And the media was so shocked by this grassroots movement, because it all came from the grassroots. Even then, none of the politicians would speak out, or very few of them. The New York Times said a new global superpower, the second global superpower, has been created, the new anti-war movement. But of course, as Cindy is mentioning, after the war began, that movement quickly dissipated. But Mike Prizner, it's shocking, and when you think back about it, when you think about all of that mobilization and the mainstream corporate-owned media said almost nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and this is, we're young men and women who joined the military, really kind of believing we're doing something right, trusting our leadership, and trusting these institutions we're told are like the most cherished institutions of our democracy, right? A free press and media. And so, we would expect that, we would hear the different sides and opinions and different rationales covered by the press. I mean, but we were watching the news every single night, every channel, every show we could find. And that demonstration was the very first a voice of opposition to the war that we heard. And so, of course, in a sea of everything else, as powerful as that demonstration was, of course, was lost on a lot of people, because they had been experiencing not just for the months and years or so after the 9/11 attacks, but years and years of conditioning and priming for this to happen. So why didn't that one demonstration turn the minds of all the soldiers that were looking for answers and everyone else in the country who was making up their mind about the war, too, is because it was years and years and years of priming for that invasion of propaganda, of stories about Saddam Hussein, of stories about how terrible Iraq is. I remember even in high school, I mean, it was common knowledge that Saddam Hussein should be taken out and the U.S. should liberate the country. This happened for a very long time. In fact, just 2 years after the September 11th attacks, there was a Washington Post poll that found 7 in 10 Americans, 2 years after 9/11, 7 in 10 Americans believed that Saddam Hussein took part in the 9/11 attacks. And so when you look at that kind of effectiveness of a propaganda campaign, you can see why, you know, the mass demonstration, as powerful as it was, you know, wasn't enough for people who were still on the fence.
Cindy, we have a situation where it seems like the corporate-owned media functions really as an echo chamber for government, for the U.S. government propaganda. We call it the free press. It's free because some number of billionaires own these different media outlets, and the conglomeration and monopoly practices within the media means fewer and fewer real media corporations actually have the news, or, and you know, have an alternative news or any news that's not going along with the line. Again, just for people, and I want to talk about the media, because before February 15th, 2003, for that year before, a few of us were on MSNBC or CNBC or Fox News or CNN. And then it turned out that right before the war started, all of the few voices on these channels disappeared. We were taken off. And in our place were retired colonels and generals and admirals. And even the studios, the set design for the studios made Iraq look like a big battlefield. And they were standing on top of the Iraq battlefield, and they're talking about, well, the tanks will come this way and the planes will come this way. The debate was no longer at all about should there or should there not be a war. It was just about how the war was going to be implemented. And I don't think anything has changed since 2003 as it affects or as it is represented in the corporate-owned media, except maybe it's gotten worse. You've been a careful observer of this. Talk about how you see it.
I just had an interview earlier, and I was talking about this, how people like General Barry McCaffrey were paid shills for the military-industrial complex, and how there was the White House Iraq group that actually met to figure out how to sell the Iraq war to the American people. And that was like just a big advertising campaign for the invasion of Iraq. And it goes back to, they did it in rural, you were talking about the advent of U.S. foreign imperialism in the late 1800s, early 1900s. Well, Wilson and his cadre kind of invented marketing wars to people. And so today I barely have the stomach to turn on the TV and watch the news. But, you know, of course, I do once in a while. And of course, I see a lot of it on social media and on the internet. But it just seems like they're just obviously, you know, making up stories, especially about the connection between Russia and the elections and things like that, to foment a Cold War. It's not bad enough that they have fomented real wars that have killed millions of people, my son included. But now, you know, they want this new Cold War because I believe they're tools of the war machine, the military-industrial complex. And if people weren't convinced in 2003, 2004, 2005 about this, I don't know how it could be any more clear that the corporate media is just a propaganda arm for the Pentagon.
In fact, Brian, you and I have talked, but just between the two of us, about how right at the time that the war was being pushed on the American people, or the idea of war was being pushed on the American people, that's when news organizations like CNN and MSNBC and others began removing anti-war voices from their shows. People like Phil Donahue, for example, who had a show on MSNBC, he was pushed off the air. So was Jesse Ventura at the same time. Both of them had spoken out against the idea of going to war. So there was this effort, even among the mainstream media, to silence the anti-war voices.
Mike Preisner, I let's stay with this theme, and because you work for a media outlet, Telesur, you're independently producing Empire Files, which is an amazing series of
fantastic
documentaries. I mean, really, Mike Preisner
first
produces
class
with Abby Martin, Empire Files. I was also involved in the anti-war movement, the first Iraq War. And I want to tell this story real quickly because it speaks directly to the centrality of the media presentation. Ramsey Clark, who had been Attorney General under Lyndon Johnson in the late 1960s, personally went along with a videographer, John Albert, and an award-winning still photographer and an Iraqi-American translator. He flew to Amman, Jordan in February 1991 in the middle of the Iraq War. And he drove from Amman, he drove to Basra, he drove to Mosul, he drove to Baghdad, unaccompanied, while the U.S. was bombing. The U.S. dropped, 89,000 or 115,000 tons of ordnance on Iraq. And Ramsey Clark was just driving all around Iraq with a videographer and a photographer, taking the only uncensored footage that came from the Iraq War, the only uncensored footage. And when he came back after this 10-day journey through Iraq and had the censor, it didn't go through an Iraqi censor, it didn't go through a Pentagon censor, the only uncensored footage of the war, those of us working with him at that time took the information, the material, the video to the main outlets, NBC, CBS, and they at first said, oh yeah, we're going to put this on the air that night. And they didn't put it on. Everybody got shut down. I believe it was NBC and CBS. And thus, the American people were deprived of seeing the only uncensored footage of the war. And what the footage showed was that the bombing of civilian targets wasn't just collateral damage, that it was a systematic bombing and then rebombing, second, third runs of what was, in essence, the infrastructure of Iraq, that which was necessary to sustain life. It showed the brutality of the war. It had nothing to do with the liberation of Kuwait per se. You're talking about downtown Baghdad, not Kuwait, not the front lines. Mike, because you're in media, because you're producing these amazing documentaries in Empire Files, it seems to me that we're in a war, an idea war, to reach the hearts and minds of the people. And the only way that we can really succeed is by having alternative media, because otherwise, it's a lost cause. Go ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, of course, there's two sides to this. I mean, there's the first is the priming and the preparing for war and all of the propaganda and lies and all of the things that the media does to prepare people for that first attack and the initiation of the war. The many things that we're seeing right now, all of the stories about North Korea, stories about Venezuela, things like that. I mean, these are the basic things they do to prime people. But then when the war starts, there's this whole other part of masking what's really happening, masking the effects on civilians, masking the mismanagement and poor planning of the war makers. And of course, this happened with the Gulf War, and of course with the invasion of Iraq that I was a part of in 2003. I think that the U.S. empire learned a lesson from the Vietnam War, because if you look up footage of the Vietnam War, you'll see that journalists were on the front lines, that the evening news was showing frontline reporting, showing destruction of civilians and showing the death of and the serious wounding of U.S. soldiers. And the U.S. empire learned a lesson from that, because that stimulated so much anti-war activism in the United States and among the military, because people were seeing a firsthand look of what was going on every single day. And with the Gulf War, they made a very specific effort to conceal that. To be a journalist that reported there, you had to be approved by the government. You had to go through all types of vetting, and they were only allowing journalists embedded with soldiers who were approved and who were going to show positive coverage. And the same thing was true with the invasion of Iraq. And I remember one of the things that, I think the first time that me and my friends there started to get really angry at the media, we hadn't seen news or newspapers for quite some months, but when we finally saw a news report, it was just a news report about a rocket that had hit the side of a building, and it was just like this kind of endless loop footage of a hole in the side of a building. And this is the reality that we had been dealing with day in and day out. I mean, that was a daily or nightly occurrence for us. And we realized that people back home had absolutely no idea what was happening in Iraq, that the politicians were saying everything's going fine. Yes, we have to report on this or that death when it happens, but overall it's going well. And what we were seeing was the opposite, that every day it was getting worse and every day it was becoming more and more of a disaster. And so this kind of extreme need to conceal from the public what's actually going on as the plans are falling apart or as the plans are working and being extremely destructive and horrible for the people they're going after, we felt that completely betrayed by the fact that the people that we were supposed to be serving back home weren't allowed to know the true extent of what was going on. And so absolutely, I mean, if we try to leave this in the hands of the corporate media, which is really profiting directly from those things. I mean, literally the same companies owning the media outlets as owning the weapons makers and things like that. Of course, we're going to get exactly the same. And so, you know, it's only been through independent reports that people saw anything else. I mean, I remember the first piece of media I saw that told the truth about Iraq was Michael Moore's film at the time. And in it, it showed IEDs blowing up U.S. soldiers. And I mean, to sit in a theater and see finally people are seeing what the reality is there, you know, it meant a lot in it, but it showed that there is a complete vacuum, a complete disconnect with what the public was allowed to see and what was happening. And it was really only independent voices that can solve that.
That's the voice of Mike Preisner. He's a producer with the Empire Files with Abby Martin on Telesur. He's an Iraq war veteran and an anti-war Iraq veteran. Cindy Sheehan, you have Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. You have your own radio show, which I encourage people to go to. You can go to cindysheehansoapbox.blogspot.com. Again, people are creating alternative media like this show and like Sputnik. And of course, the government is targeting a lot of alternative media, certainly targeting Sputnik and saying, you know, don't listen to us. We're foreign agents, blah, blah, blah. It reminds me, Cindy, when I was 19 and I told John this frequently, whenever right wingers were angry when I was passing out leaflets during the Vietnam War, they'd yell at me. When I was like 15, they'd yell, "Go back to Russia." And I was always perplexed. I was like, "Go back to Russia? What is that? I've never been to Russia." Anyway, let's talk real quick about the media too, because as Mike is saying, it's complicated. It's preparing the population for war, demonizing the target, and at the same time manipulating people afterwards. And Gold Star mothers like yourself, family members who have lost their children or loved ones in the war, are then sort of put on a pedestal, elevated in this kind of faux honoring of the families of fallen soldiers. Meanwhile, the policymakers are glad to send more young people to their death. It's kind of the cruelest and crassest kind of manipulation. And I think that's one of the reasons why your voice in the anti-war movement was so treasured by so many people and so important and so feared by the government. We have about 2 minutes left.
Well, right. And you don't know how many Memorial Day things I was featured in the first year here in Vacaville. The second year, not so much. I wasn't even invited because then I started to speak out against the empire that killed my son. And I'm so glad to hear Michael's voice and hear him doing so well because, like you said, they're happy to send more children to kill other people's children. And then when they get back from these wars, it's very hard for them to access help and the benefits that they need. And so many of the young people that I worked with aren't with us anymore because they've committed suicide or they got involved in drugs. So it's just a terrible cycle of wars and discarding our veterans when they come back. And, you know, the best thing that we can do is try to prevent them. And I want people to look up the Women's March on the Pentagon. We're going to try to have a big anti-war response in October.
Okay, that'll be October 21st in 2018, I believe. And Mike Preisner, we'll give you the last word. You've been working with veterans who are dealing with issues of post-traumatic stress, suicide. You've been to the bases. You've been working with them. Just talk about here we are 15 years later. What is it like for those veterans who serve 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 tours in Iraq? And of course, their family members. Go ahead. 30 seconds.
I mean, it's a devastated generation. I mean, all of us who participated in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. I mean, I think if I counted on my hand, the number of people that I worked with in the anti-war movement, half or more are gone from suicide or addiction or whatever else. I mean, when George W. Bush is paraded around on television now and goes on talk shows and people talk about, oh, if only we had George W. Bush back, I mean, this man deserves to be in jail. And I think that all of the things that soldiers are dealing with today and that many more will deal with who are still being sent to Afghanistan, still being sent to Iraq, who will be sent to Iran or whatever the next target is, that, you know, we need to fight for help for these people, but we need to fight to stop those wars. But for real justice, I mean, we need to put those people in jail that sent us there, that are the reason that so many died and the reason that so many families' lives are destroyed today. We know who they are. We know what they did. And it's very easy to arrest them, try them, and put them in prison for the rest of their lives.
We're going
to
leave it right there. That was Mike Preisner, anti-war documentary filmmaker and Iraq anti-war veteran. We've been also joined from the Bay Area by Cindy Sheehan. She is an anti-war activist and journalist whose son, Casey, was killed during the Iraq War. And you can hear her all the time, every week, at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. I want to thank Cindy Sheehan and Mike Prisner for joining us on the 15th anniversary of the historic 2003 anti-war demonstrations. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today, we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He is a writer for Shadowproof.com, and he's the co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News. Kevin and Paul, welcome back. Thanks so much.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Paul, I want to start with you. I'm looking at an article about the situation of having trans women in men's prisons, which, as it turns out, is not uncommon in the United States. And actually, as you pointed out before the show began, started many decades ago. In this article, it talks about a trans woman who is known in the court system now as Jane Doe. She's in a prison in Massachusetts on a minor nonviolent drug charge, and she was put into a men's prison. She's lived as a woman for 40 years. She transitioned more than 40 years ago, but has been forcibly placed in the men's facility, where she's been subject to terrible things, including rape. Her case is now slowly winding its way through the courts. What can you tell us about this as a nationwide problem? Is this a nationwide problem?
Yeah, sadly it is. I mean, you know, I think that one of the things that people really underestimate, I think, is kind of how reactionary and brutal prison and jail administrators are in this country, and how many times the course of action that they take, it's almost as if they deliberately go out of their way to come up with things that will harm the people in their care and subject them to brutality and dehumanization and sexual assault, as you noted. And there's actually kind of like a long history of transgender prisoners being placed in facilities that are not in accordance with their gender. And the Supreme Court's actually heard this case in 1994, over 20 years ago, in a case named Farmer versus Brennan, where Dee Farmer was a transsexual federal prisoner who was being held in a federal prison, and she was in a male maximum security federal prison where she was sexually assaulted, and she claimed in her lawsuit that the risk to her safety should have been obvious because she was transgender. It should have been obvious that she was at high risk of attack, and the Supreme Court agreed with her. Ultimately, the case lost, though, but it kind of set the legal standard that prison officials cannot be oblivious to the risk. That said, around the country, you have transgender prisoners who are being housed in prisons with members of the opposite sex, often at considerable risk, and the courts have a really mixed track record in terms of doing anything on it. You mentioned Massachusetts, and a couple years ago, a male prisoner was transitioning to be a woman. All the medical experts were in agreement that he suffered from gender dysphoria, which that's the medical term for people who are transgender, and that the only thing that would resolve this was sex reassignment surgery. And the federal district court judge in Boston ordered the surgery, and then the First Circuit Court of Appeals reversed it. And their thing was, well, you know, taxpayers shouldn't have to pay for it, even though by incarcerating people, the prisoners are kind of deprived of it. And that's in the context that the state of Massachusetts spent hundreds of thousands of dollars, not millions of dollars, in legal fees defending its position. And, you know, so they kind of have this long history of, you know,
kind of transgender bigotry. And a lot of these prison systems just sum up their policy as, you know, we're going to assign people in whatever prison they're in, either based on their genitals or based on what their gender was at birth, which is kind of maybe like a 1950s view of gender type thing, but of gender relations, I would say. But the problem is that transgender people in general are still somewhat marginalized in this country, and I think they're even more marginalized when they're in prison in the criminal justice system. And I think we shouldn't underestimate, I think, the fact that a lot of the people that run our prisons and jails, they're not just politically conservative, but a lot of them are also evangelical Christians.
That's true. And in fact, there was another case in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania called Blatt versus Cabela's, in which the court ruled that the exception, I hate to even call it an exception, but I'm going to call it the protection for transgender Americans under the Americans with Disabilities Act was not legally correct. It ruled that people who are transgender can be discriminated under the Americans with Disabilities Act because, well, basically the finding was they're not really men or they're not really women, that gender dysphoria is a recognized and diagnosable medical condition. And so it's different. Kevin, you wrote a lot over the years about Chelsea Manning and her transition while she was incarcerated at the military prison at Leavenworth, Kansas. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I would say that the military prison system, as I came to understand it, is actually somehow it manages to be worse than the federal system. And I know that there were discussions about options as to whether Chelsea could even be transferred to a federal prison so that she could maybe get the hormone therapy that she wanted for treatment of the gender identity issues that she was confronting. And so that became very apparent that the U.S. military had this, you know, bigotry and went out of its way institutionally to delay any changes, and they really resisted the ACLU's efforts to get them to change their policies. And I think something that needs to be made very clear, regardless of whether you're in a military prison, is actually probably far, far worse in federal prisons, is just that these people who, these trans prisoners are very, very vulnerable to sexual abuse, sexual harassment, correctional officers preying upon their bodies and taking advantage of them, placing them in solitary confinement. Back in August of 2015, my colleague Brian Sonnenstein covered this survey by a prison abolition group, LGBTQ group called Black and Pink. And just some of the stories that they were sharing were just horrible about how dehumanizing, you know, everything is. You know, for example, you know, being mistreated simply because an officer thinks you're just too sissy-like or you're too girly in the way that you act. And so, you know, there's really no way that people are going to stick up and defend you if an officer is attacking you. You already know, based on your experience, John, how difficult it is to bring justice to people who are harassing or intimidating you in prison, and it's even worse for these marginalized people.
Awful. I want to read you a quote from a woman named Leslie Webster, who is a Black trans woman from Atlanta. She was placed in a male prison facility. She says here, "They couldn't decide if they should put me in with the women or the men, so they put me in a pod called mental health where they put transgender women. While I was there, I got disrespected a lot by the police because they would call me sir instead of miss, but it only got worse. They cut off all my hair and they locked me away in a cell for 90 days by myself because they didn't want to put me with the men and they couldn't put me with the women." You know, and I'm fascinated by a statistic that's in this same article, which says that 21% of all trans women have been incarcerated, and that's compared to a 5% incarceration rate among the general population. But the rate is 47% for Black trans women. 47% of all Black trans women have been imprisoned. It seems to me that the problem of treatment for transgender individuals, while it's been around for a long time, is actually getting worse in this age of mass incarceration. Paul, over to you.
Yeah, well, I think that this is just a reflection is that because I think a lot of transgender people face job discrimination, they're unable to get employment in the, you know, in the legal economy, the legal sector. A lot of transgender people turn to the illegal economy either for sex work or the drug trade to, you know, to make ends meet, and that kind of brings them into full confrontation with the American police state, which winds up getting them locked up and incarcerated. And then I also think, too, there's also the, we have a very, you know, our policing system of the American police state also has a lot of, the police have a lot of discretion, so do prosecutors, but that also means that there's a lot of discretion to be abused. And it allows for, you know, it allows for prejudice, both in who gets arrested, who gets prosecuted, and things like that. So it could well be that crimes that biological woman may not be arrested for, or, you know, wouldn't even be a crime or whatever. If you're transgender, it is bringing you into contact with the police state. And I think that one of the things that we've seen, I think a lot of the analysis and the scholarship that's taken place, I think, in the last 10 or 15 years around racial disparities, I think also applies here, as it goes down to the thing is that when the people that are doing the arresting and doing the prosecuting have unlimited, unreviewed discretion, there's a good chance that they're going to be enforcing their biases in how that discretion is enforced. And I think that also comes up also in sentencing, where, you know, they've done analysis of judges' sentences, and even in states that have gone to determinate sentencing, where you have white defendants convicted of the same offense as black defendants, on average, spread out across all the judges and all the defendants that are sentenced, the black defendants, like, collectively get, it's not a huge amount of time, it'll be like 7 to 13 or 15 months more on their sentence in aggregate than the white defendants do. And, you know, and I think that's one of those things that as long as we have a system that's not transparent, it's not accountable, and the key players, the police in terms of who they arrest and prosecutors in terms of who they prosecute, and even judges in terms of who they sentence and how they sentence them, you know, those are all problems. It certainly allows for the injection of personal bias, whether that's, you know, racial, gender, classist, or whatever.
And also, we have to recognize that personal bias, as Paul and Kevin are pointing out, are really social biases.
That's right.
They're the enforced biases that come from decades, really centuries, of oppression and of discrimination. So, in addition, Kevin and Paul, in addition to transparency and accountability, it would be necessary for prisons and police to recognize this as a problem and then have requisite training to overcome the social biases, which are, you know, come into the prison or come into the jail or come into society the way, you know, the way air comes into our lungs. It's seemingly unnoticed, but it's all there. Are there any efforts underway, given the institutional and systemic character of this particular problem, where there is an effort to retrain police or jail guards or prison guards?
I'm not aware of any, and I think that on the one hand, your bigger systems, your bigger police departments, your bigger prison systems, I think they may have the training, but I think that the big thing is the big disconnect isn't so much what's happening as far as the training goes, but how things are actually enforced on the ground. You can have all kinds of training, but in the event that if they don't have, you know, a reliable complaint mechanism, and they also don't have a means for investigating complaints and doing something about them, you know, all the policies in the world aren't really going to do anything. And I think that's where the systems fall flat, is that there's no real mechanism for, there's no real mechanism for ensuring that the transgender prisoner who's been discriminated against can, you know, can voice a complaint. Then there's also the whole, reality, too, is that given the power disparities a lot and the reality that retaliation is common against prisoners who complain. I think these are all kind of multi-layered approaches. That said, is that, you know, in urban cities, larger cities that have more politically empowered GLBT communities, for example, are less likely to do stuff like this than the places where there's less political power involved. And literally it comes down to, I think, you know, how many rights you have or how well those rights are respected literally depends a lot on where you live.
Indeed. Let's turn to another subject. Kevin, Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner last week confirmed the existence of a list of police officers that the Philadelphia DA in the past has maintained. The list was secretly compiled, and it's a list of all Philadelphia police officers who they know had a history of lying, racial bias, or brutality, and a move to try to block them from testifying in court. Krasner has now confirmed the existence of this list. It's quite something that the DA would have a list like this, but the issue of firing police officers for racism and lying and false testimony, that's not it.
And remember, it was a secret list. This isn't something that was circulated so that the public has, you know, the ability to know which of these police officers are corrupt or are liars or are working, you know, to incarcerate innocent people. It was a secret list.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Well, yeah, I think what's remarkable about this is just if it's not being acted upon, if you've got this list and you're not doing anything about these officers, then you're definitely putting the safety and well-being of all the people in Philadelphia at risk. And, you know, I'm not in Philadelphia. It's more difficult to speak to it as a local issue. But I'd say nationally, if you take it city by city, and even if I compare my experiences here in Chicago with, you know, a rather notorious Chicago police department, you know, what is clear is that you have contracts with the city that protect these police officers from any sort of justice. It's very difficult. It's even difficult for whistleblowers from within the police organizations to come out and accuse their fellow officers of things like embezzling drug money or taking advantage a little bit off the top in their operations and trying to enrich themselves, which are things that aren't actually dealing with, you know, whether that person was torturing a black person or whether that person was involved in a shooting where they planted a weapon on someone, things that police are known to do to cover up what they actually are guilty of doing. And so when I look at this story, I think, you know, what's remarkable is there's a secret list. And what I know vaguely about Krasner is that there's a lot of high expectations among progressives that he's going to be a strong district attorney and he's going to turn against people within. We saw that when in his first week in office, there were people within the institution that just, you know, were surprised to find that they were getting pink slips, that they were fired. They were not going to be brought back to be part of his administration. And I think this is kind of a first test for Krasner as to how he's going to deal with police in the city.
I'd like to talk also a little bit more about corruption among the police or among officials in prisons. On Kevin's website, shadowproof.com, his colleague Brian Sonnenstein has a piece called New York Jail Inspectors Smuggle Contraband into Jails, Find Culture of Corruption Alive and Well. And what this was an undercover investigation where an investigator posing as a corrections officer smuggled drugs, alcohol, and razor blades into jails in Manhattan and Brooklyn and was never caught. We're talking about two scalpel blades, 26.8 grams of marijuana, and five strips of the prescription opiate substitute Suboxone, which I can tell you is wildly popular in prison. And no one ever stopped him. And but before I go to Paul and to Kevin to comment on this, I'll tell you one short story. I had a visit while I was in prison. At the end of the visit, you have to be strip searched before you go back into the prison itself. And I said to the CO who was strip searching me, "Hey, have you ever found anybody smuggling anything back into the prison with these strip searches?" And he said, "No, I've never found anything, but that's how drugs get into the prison." And I said, "Oh, come on now." I said, we all sit in the visitor's room in full view of four corrections officers. There are 10 cameras in the ceiling all around the room. And you're saying that a visitor has contraband in their body cavities. They pull that bag of contraband out somehow in full view of these 10 cameras and four cops or six cops, however many there are on any given day.
This is a almost starting to sound like a comedy routine, but go ahead.
They give it to the prisoner, who then gets it somehow into one of his body cavities and get through the strip search. Or are you guys bringing it in? And he said, I'm not going to touch that with a 10-foot pole, because that's exactly how contraband gets into prisons. It's not visitors bringing it in. It's not drones dropping it in. It's the cops bringing it in. Paul, go ahead. You've got long experience with this kind of thing.
Sure, and I think that's one of the things, too. And I think that, you know, when we talk about the lack of transparency and the inherent corruption of the prison and jail system in this country, is I think that's one of the big things about it, is that virtually all the contraband, not all of it, but certainly the vast majority of it, is brought into prisons and jails by corrupt guards. And it's interesting because right now the Federal Communications Commission is weighing efforts to allow prison officials and jail officials to block cell phones. But basically what this is a tacit admission that they're totally incapable of preventing their corrupt employees from smuggling cell phones as well as drugs and whatever into prisons and jails. And when you look at the fact, like in California alone last year, they're confiscating around 12,000 cell phones each year. And it's like 12,000 cell phones out of a prison population of around 140,000 prisoners. That means one cell phone's being confiscated for every 10 prisoners. And I think in some respects, it's the fact that they're even bothering to confiscate them, I think, is something that they do just to keep the market demand up. Because otherwise, you know, once prisoners have a cell phone, it's not a consumable. They generally last a couple of years. But by perpetually confiscating them, it allows them to keep the demand and keep the prices up. So half the guards are confiscating them and the other half are bringing them in. And the amounts of the bribes that are being charged are, you know, they're fairly substantial. I mean, prison guards are charging $500 to $600 a piece just to smuggle in a cell phone. The rates are higher when they smuggle in drugs and other, you know, prohibited items. But I also think that's one of the things, too, though, is the fact that, you know, no one in a position of power in America is calling for anything to be done about corruption by law enforcement staff. And that applies not just to prison and jail guards who smuggle contraband in, but also to corrupt police officers as well. And the fact that we have this tacit, if not encouragement, but almost the blind eye, the nudge, nudge, wink, wink, of course we know they're all corrupt, by the people who are supposed to be enforcing our law enforcement system, I think is one of the big disgraces of American law enforcement, is the tacit toleration and encouragement of this level of corruption.
Because they're on a pedestal, too,
yeah.
John. I mean, the it's police true. Are like, we blue lives matter more than all other lives.
Mm-hmm.
It's putting these people on a pedestal. It is a corrupt system, and thus they are able, you know, as no accountability, they have carte blanche.
Yeah, and Kevin, before we turn it over to you, I want to preface this question. When I was incarcerated, it was actually quite straightforward and quite easy to get a cell phone or a wheel of cheese or whatever it was that your heart desired. One of the prisoners who had been there for more than a decade told me very plainly which guards were the ones bringing in the contraband, and that the price was 10 times whatever the guard paid for it on the street. So what you would do is you'd put in your order. Your family would transfer the money to the guard's account, and then the guard would buy the items and smuggle them in for you. I've made jokes over the last few years that I gained 35 pounds when I was in prison because the Italians befriended me, and we ate like kings. We had pork loins and chicken marsala and wonderful wines for the marsala sauces and fresh Parmesan cheese that we would grate ourselves and garlic and you name it. We had it. And it was because of crooked cops bringing it in at a very high price, but they were bringing it in. Over to you, Kevin.
Well, what I'd say quickly is that what's really important about this inspections report from New York is that right now there's the big push to close down Rikers Island, and Mayor Bill de Blasio just made an announcement basically about the same time that we're recording this segment here on February 15th. And the fact that there's such this corruption within these institutions, I think there's a lot of people who are concerned that we're going to shuffle inmates to new facilities. It's looking like there's going to be jails in four boroughs with a new site in the Bronx, and you're going to move people around, but you're not going to do anything about this culture that's allowing contraband in. Meanwhile, we have to mention that there are very, very tough restrictions on visitors. Even, you know, at Rikers Island, there have been horrible stories written by this one journalist, Raven Rakia. She's a black woman. She's done some tremendous work on this and written for, like, The Intercept and other outlets about people who go to Rikers to visit their family members, and they're strip searched, and they're very treated to very invasive searches that they have to go through just so that they can have those visits, which I think to some extent becomes a deterrent. I mean, it has a way of demoralizing and possibly discouraging you from going to visit.
Sure. Sure it does.
It's awful. I mean, it's really it's a form of punishment. It's punishment.
Yeah, they pay lip service. The prison administrations pay lip service to keeping the family together and visitation and an easy transition back into society. And that's all just a big lie. We only have 2 minutes. I want to close by going over to another issue. Paul, there was a report published by Reason Magazine, the Reason Foundation's a libertarian foundation here in Washington.
Yes, right there. Mm-hmm.
And it's entitled 81 Federal Prisoners Have Died While Waiting for the Government to Decide If They Were Sick Enough to Go Home. Now, the federal system has this this policy where if you are ill, you can apply for compassionate release, right, and go home and die with your family. In fact, it's almost never granted. You could probably count on one or two hands nationwide the number of times someone has been granted compassionate release. Go ahead.
And let me, Paul, before you answer, also help the audience understand how many people in prison are senior citizens?
I think the last number out of 2.5 million people, around 10% of them are over the age of 55, and that number is going up incrementally because we have so many people that have been sentenced to death by incarceration that are literally going to die in prison because their sentences are so long. But as far as the compassionate release thing, that's almost kind of like the big misnomer. And this also plays itself out in the states around the country as well, where prisoners that are terminally ill, they're on the verge of death, and basically they just don't get released. And that number actually seems pretty low to me, because we've been reporting on and covering compassionate release issues for a long time now. And then the other one is that the prisoners, you know, finally they get released and they die a day later after, you know, they die within a day or so of being released. But it seems that the majority of the prisoners that apply for compassionate release never get it, only to die while their applications are basically being dawdled with in a bureaucratic never land that's designed to perpetuate death than misery rather than actually, you know, carrying out the function of releasing people to die outside of prison.
You know, it's really something, Kevin. We have less than a minute. The prisons themselves become a naturally occurring retirement community. And here you have, I mean, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. elderly people who are in prison. Take us out, if you would, Kevin.
Well, the only thing I'd leave you with is just, if you want to talk about compassionate release, I know that this was a state issue, but I'm drawn to what Paul just said. You had Herman Wallace, one of the Angola Three. He had been 41 years in solitary. He's dying from cancer. They let him out, and then days later, he dies from liver cancer. I mean, talk about compassionate release. You don't really get any time outside of prison to die.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from Chicago by Kevin Gostala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we've been joined from Lake Worth, Florida, by Paul Wright, the founder and executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center. He is also the editor of Prison Legal News. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.